Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And please consider joining in some group or some type of prayer circle or what have you. And we need to start praying for all of us to start actually taking a stand, because it can't be one person. We can't just pray for Trump to save us. We're a Republican form of government, not a democracy, but it means that we're representative, and we actually have to start praying for the people to hold their representatives accountable. The president is not our representative. He's the executive. So with that, we've got Tammy with us, and we just finished the Constitution, the formal seven articles. Now, at the very end, because we kind of ran out of time yesterday, at the very end of the Constitution are instructions from the convention to Continental Congress to basically lay out what to do as this goes forward, and if the Constitution is ratified, then what to do. And then after that, we'll go into the Bill of Rights, and we'll really focus only on the Bill of Rights, because we've already focused on the 11th Amendment, and we've talked about the 12th Amendment, we've covered that in detail, because the rest of the amendments we'll just kind of do a summary on. But what we'll actually do is focus a little more on the amendments that have been suggested and never ratified. Because, folks, when you look at amendments that have been presented that did not get ratified, then, you know, it's a telltale sign of, we think that this is something that's really important and it didn't get ratified. And why either it didn't get ratified or, you know, why it was suggested. And there's always a story there that, you know, gives us more insight as to maybe a real problem and or something that, you know, well, we'll get into each of them because it's all case by case. But by each of the amendments that were suggested is kind of an indicative or an indictment of the times and what was really going on. So anyway, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And so are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're at the very end of the Constitution, and we've got, you know, the little statement that we kind of covered that was a unanimous by the states. In other words, the majority of the members of each of the states there passed or voted to, you know, to sign or present this Constitution. So in other words, it was unanimous by the states, not unanimous by the members or the delegates that were in the convention. And then it lists the names of those who signed. And then so this went out. And so when they looked at Massachusetts, they realized that Eldridge Gerry's name wasn't on there. You know, hey, how come your name was dropped? Oh, well, because I didn't sign it. They go, well, what's your problem with it? And that was the same thing with Virginia. When we look at Virginia, it was only John Blair and James Madison. And there was two names that were withheld from that. But the reason why, so people go, okay, the 2-2, that's not, Washington was the other. George Mason was one, and I forget who the other person was. But anyway, Governor Randolph. So Governor Randolph was the other dissenter along with George Mason. But because George Washington did sign the Constitution, that gave them three. Does that make sense? So there was a majority of Virginia. So each of the states had a majority. And as a matter of fact, it was pretty unanimous by all the small states. When you look at the delegates from the really small, you know, in those days, the walkover states, because today we call them flyover states. They didn't have airplanes back then. So Delaware, that was unanimous. I mean, every member of the Delaware delegation, they all voted for it. Why? Because they recognized that this Constitution was going to protect that state's sovereignty, because that was the intent, that was the purpose behind the federal government, was to protect the dignity and sovereignty of each of the states as well as the Union. which is, you know, when we look today, what the heck happened? Why is our federal government not protecting the sovereignty of each of these states? Why is it that they're throwing us out into the clutches and the arms of the global communists and so forth? But anyway, let's dive down a little bit further past the signatures. And so it basically, you know, we kind of covered the signing of in the year of our Lord, all of that, and then resolve. So from that point, there's this little instruction given. So let's go ahead and dive into that.
The New Hampshire?
Yeah. So actually, no. Underneath that, there's the resolve.
Oh, resolved. Okay.
Yes. So that proceeding, right?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Resolved that the preceding Constitution be laid before the United States in Congress assembled, and that it is the opinion of this convention that it should afterwards be submitted to a convention of delegates chosen in each state by the people thereof under the recommendation of its legislature for their assent and ratification, and that each convention assenting to and ratifying the same should give notice thereof to the United States in Congress assembled. Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, keep going, yeah.
Okay. Resolved that it is the opinion of this convention that as soon as the conventions of 9 states shall have ratified this Constitution, the United States in Congress assembled should fix a day on which electors should be appointed by the states which have ratified the same, and a day on which the electors should assemble to vote for the president, and the time and place for commencing proceedings under this Constitution. That after such publication, the electors should be appointed and the senators and representatives elected. That the electors should meet on the day fixed for the election of the president and should transmit their votes certified, signed, sealed, and directed as the Constitution requires to the Secretary of the United States in Congress assembled. That the senators and representatives should convene at the time and place assigned. That the senators should appoint a president of the Senate for the sole purpose of receiving, opening, and counting the votes for president, and that after he shall be chosen, the Congress, together with the president, should without delay proceed to execute this Constitution.
So in other words, this is the instructions, because when you look at the Constitution and the Electoral College has to be opened by the vice president, who is the president of the Senate, which at that point in time, because they haven't selected who the vice president and president are, but they will have selected who the House of Representatives would be and who their senators would be in that same election. In other words, in the federal election preceding the first session, for the first time that, you know, this federal government, you know, commences, they don't have a president and a vice president, but they do have the representatives. So they had to create some instruction on how to kickstart this federal government so that they could kind of breathe legitimate life based on the system. So anyway, this is kind of how it all peeled out. And when we look at how they ratified at the state level, how they talk about the convention by delegates chosen in each state and so forth, that really lays down this the message that they didn't trust many of the state legislatures who had been basically violating the Articles of Confederation and literally becoming these, I'll just say, these cesspools of corruption. Now, that's really hyperbole. Because it's not like we were living in those days. It's not like in these states at this very point in time in the 1787, 1788, that the state legislatures were literally cesspools of corruption like, you know, Caligula of Rome. No, it was really, you know, power was already getting to their heads. They were just ignoring what they were supposed to do in preserving the Union. Because remember, the Articles of Confederation was supposed to be a perpetual document to actually preserve the Union. But because it did not have the capability of enforcing anything, these states realized that they could already wiggle away from and there would be no consequences. So we're seeing how six of the states, and going through the ratification debates, these six states actually acknowledge their behavior, their bad behavior, because they pointed to themselves. When you read North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, they all pointed to themselves of how they were having problems. And so it's very revealing in, you know, in each of these states, because they were quick to kind of point the finger to others, but there, you know, the honesty factor always came out. Hey, we were equally, you know, culpable in violating the treaties and printing our own money and so forth. So anyway, all right. So we now have an understanding of how they actually initiated the government by creating a little bit of latitude on how to form the counting of the Electoral College and so forth. And it went without a hitch. In other words, there was really a very peaceful transition from the Articles of Confederation into this new Continental Congress. And or from Continental Congress into, I should say, this new framework of three branches of government, from a judiciary, president, and an executive, away from the Continental Congress. So now that they created this new government, the very first thing that was the order of business for James Madison was to create a Bill of Rights. And as a matter of fact, on our website, on reclaimingtherepublic.org, if you go to the Constitutional Articles page, you'll find the Bill of Rights, or I should say the debates in Congress regarding the Bill of Rights, available right there for you. And actually, I believe we include how Madison presented for the first time, and it was in May, because the Congress and the federal government actually convened in May. And so when they started doing their business, and even though they didn't have quorum, I think there was one state or two states that hadn't shown up yet, Madison presented to, you know, those in attendance, to the body of the whole, that it was his intent to create, or to basically submit, that we needed to have a committee, and it was his intent to help sponsor or support the idea of creating a Bill of Rights. Now, when you read through this, everybody in the room basically said, no way. Why are you asking to amend this Constitution? Let's kick the tires on this. Now, remember, there was all of this hyperbole on this, oh, we need to have this Bill of Rights. We got to have it. Even though the Constitution was ratified by every state that said we don't need it. And so Madison all of a sudden kind of turned the tables and said, we need to do this, and it's my intent to, you know, help sponsor and support this, you know, this body of work, whether we do this in the convention, because he actually presented this to Congress. Do we do this as the body of the whole, or do we create a subcommittee? And eventually they create the subcommittee. But prior to, like I said, he brought it up twice. The first time they just completely ignored it. And then all of a sudden, in comes this little writ from the, I believe it was a petition from the state legislature of Virginia, requesting and submitting that they're requesting a constitutional convention. In other words, they were playing the power play of Article 5 by submitting their petition to convene a convention to amend this Constitution. And everybody goes, that's kind of interesting. They're wanting to amend the Constitution. But prior to them doing that, Madison submitted that we need to convene this committee to do this. Well, now some people would say, well, maybe Madison had, you know, was playing this power game, kind of like Hamilton, that Madison had these, you know, these fingers back in the Virginia state legislature, and he didn't. As a matter of fact, to prove that he didn't, when you look at the election process after the ratification in Virginia, and they've ratified the Constitution, they started planning the election for sending senators and representatives into this new Congress, it was Patrick Henry that created the districts and ensured, actually, it was Patrick Henry that ensured that the state legislature did not select Madison to be a senator. It was literally a slap in Madison's face when, you know, here he was so involved in creating this thing called the Constitution, and he was so pivotal in this process that that Patrick Henry rewarded him by saying, "You will not serve. You will not represent this state." And then Patrick Henry was the guy that actually created and played with the congressional districts so that Madison would not have a favorable opportunity to be elected as a representative. In other words, what we call gerrymandering was actually, you know, done before, well before Eldridge Gerry. And it's actually gerrymandering, not Gerry. But Eldridge Gerry is, you know, known for this infamous thing that he did when Patrick Henry did it even far better than him prior to Eldridge Gerry playing with the boundaries and so forth. And so what ended up happening was what Patrick Henry did was he set James Monroe as a viable candidate to basically compete against James Madison, and then he threw, you know, his endorsements behind Monroe so that, you know, there was it was an uphill battle for Madison. And these two men actually went around and campaigned together, like, you know, like friends, and they became friends. And Madison ended up winning. But the point is that Patrick Henry did everything he could to make sure that Madison didn't go there. So going back to this whole premise, was Madison involved with the state legislature in some cahoots to get them to petition? Not at all. There was nothing, you know, corrupt or nothing, you know, on the side being done between Madison and that state legislature. Now, where was Continental Congress? Or I should say not Continental Congress. Where was the U.S. Congress and where was the U.S. government seated? Or where were they? What was the seat of government in 1789? Most people think, well, it was in Pennsylvania before it went to D.C. Actually, the first 2 years, if I remember correctly, they were seated in New York. So, in other words, it was long travel for many people in the South to get to New York, but the reason that they chose New York was just due to the fact that, you know, it had a good port, a very accessible port, and the fact that it was a hub and a well-developed area. The other city that was very, you know, had great potential, but it just wasn't a great port, was Philadelphia. And so they moved after the 2 years from New York down to Philadelphia. And there's lots of stories about, you know, what happened in the first sessions and so forth, but that's not important for what we're talking today. We're talking about the Constitution, and I'm trying to set the stage up that Madison, you know, basically presented this idea. Virginia came forward and said, hey, or I should say, the state petitioned Congress for the convention. Then after that, Madison made a comment, or basically addressed the body of the whole and said, I really believe we need to select a committee, or the body of the whole needs to present a Bill of Rights. And they said, no way, we're not going to do this. You know, we've got more important things to do right now. And so they again pushed it off after Virginia. Well, the next week, and right after Madison had basically asked to do it again, guess what happened? New York actually petitioned the Congress for a constitutional convention. And when Madison got up, everybody knew what he was going to say. And so, and actually, the other thing was that there was this balcony in this room where Congress was seated, and that's where they talked about the peanut gallery, because that's where the women and the people observing Congress, because this was something to be seen. This was the first free government that went from one transition without a revolution into a new form of government completely. So there was just a lot of really good things that were happening, but more importantly, Madison got up after New York petitioned, and he said, we really need to do something, or another state and another state and another state. And he basically compelled them. He said, look, I've said this before and I'll say it again. the states were demanding during the ratification process that we create a Bill of Rights. And I believe we can create a Bill of Rights that will be significant and actually helpful. We need to do this. And so they finally succumbed. And I'm not sure who the chair of the committee was, whether it was him or Roger Sherman. But I know Madison got a lot of flack just because, I don't know, he was the smallest guy in the room and they just didn't have a lot of respect for him at first. But he got a lot of flack from these guys. And I think it's probably Roger Sherman that was the chair of the committee. And that's when they went in. And I think I've talked about this before. And I'll just briefly say that the first order of business regarding the amendments and this Bill of Rights was how were they going to inject, maybe it wasn't the first order of business, but it was one of the key arguments that they really had to settle, was how were they going to inject the amendments? Were they going to actually, you know, write them in, and in other words, republish the Constitution, or were they going to keep the Constitution affixed and then just create amendments at the end? Roger Sherman preferred the latter, and Madison was basically presenting and pushing for the former. In other words, Madison wanted to see the changes made to the language so that we didn't have any mistakes in going, well, that's what this says, and not worry about the amendments, because amendments are typically ignored, because when you're looking at the articles, they go, okay, well, that's what's important. That's what we got to do. And so anyway, it ended up going on Sherman's favor, where they actually ended up with presenting the amendments at the end. So anyway, now we have the Bill of Rights. And what they did, and I've mentioned this before, that there are three preambles. The very first preamble is "We the People." And then the second preamble is that introduction to the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8. The third preamble in the Constitution is right here at the beginning of the Bill of Rights. And so this is where you come in again, Tammy. Go ahead and read those three lines, because this is the preamble. Go ahead.
Articles in addition to and amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America, proposed by Congress and ratified by the legislatures of the several states pursuant to the fifth article of the original Constitution.
So, no, are you there with the Bill of Rights? Do you see the Bill of Rights on the color-coded Constitution?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. And it says the convention of a number of states.
Oh, okay. There's a little
triangle.
Is,
oh, okay.
There's a little triangle that I have to click into to see that.
Oh.
Yeah, it's weird.
Okay. So that's what we're looking for.
Okay. So let me do it again.
Okay.
The convention of a number of states, having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added.
Okay, so that right there explains why these following amendments were being added to the Constitution. So Madison wanted to go on record to say, you asked for it, and here we gave it to you right here. And so in the process, by the way, Congress sent out a query out to each of the states, or a data call to each of the states, saying, give us what you think are important amendments to this Constitution. Well, they had already, most all the states had already sent in, because we kind of covered this in the ratification process, most all of the states provided what they would like to see as amendments. And therefore, they went out and said, it's kind of like a final data call. Here's your last call. What would you like to see done or amended to this Constitution to make it improved? And so this is why they added this. And the highlighted part isn't that this is being abused. This is something that is that important that we needed to highlight. And so when we come back, I will kind of go over this, this highlight, and why this highlight is so important. And then I'll have a question for Tammy, because, you know, it's always good to make people think. And so we will come right back with the highlights and why that's highlighted, and the question for Tammy. So Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so Madison wanted to make sure that everybody understood what this was. These were further declaratory restrictive clauses. Remember the Constitution, when we covered this past summer, we highlighted that the Constitution was enumerating roles, responsibilities, powers, property, and so forth. What you see here are not enumerations. These are negative enumerations. In other words, they can't do these things. Everything in the Constitution from Article 1 to 7 was providing them, you know, the authority to do things, a delegation of roles, a delegation of powers, and so forth. So when we look at this and the Bill of Rights, there's nothing that is delegating them any authority. In other words, when you look at an amendment in the Bill of Rights, like the expression of religion, Congress shall make no law respecting religion. And so, and we'll dive into each of these. But the point is that that does not give them any jurisdiction to hear anything regarding religion in the courts. They just have no jurisdiction, period, on those things. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's the same thing with the right to bear arms shall not be infringed. That means that Congress, even though they do have responsibilities over the militia, that the states actually own and possess the militia, and they have all cognizance over the militia. Now, one of the things, and the reason why they added the Second Amendment, was because as Madison was going through the Bill of Rights with everybody, and one of the arguments was, we don't need a Bill of Rights. The states have that. The states will take care of that. Madison pointed out that the majority of the states don't have a Bill of Rights, and he already noted that there was one particular state that was actually creating negatives or restrictions on the people's rights to bear arms. And so, boom, everybody was going, well, okay, so I guess this makes sense, that we need to kind of create a normal playing field to ensure, one, the federal government wouldn't meddle with any of these things, but these other things were very important that they were going to be maintained. So as we kind of dive forward, we go into the very First Amendment. But my question for you, because we hear this all the time, I hear people make arguments that, oh, you know what, the First Amendment is the most important amendment because that's why they put it first. Have you ever heard that?
Sure.
You know, and people say, oh, well, you know, one of the most important amendments is the Second Amendment. That's why it's in the front. That's why it's towards the very top. No, actually, with that argument, then one would think that the real First Amendment would be really a doozy. But the point is, the very First Amendment did not get ratified. But I will tell you that when you read the First Amendment and you go, why did they make this one first? So let's read this and let's give it some cognitive power to try to say, Why was this so important? So go ahead. The article, the first, not ratified.
Okay. After the first enumeration required by the first article of the Constitution, there shall be one representative for every 30,000, until the number shall amount to 100, after which the proportion shall be so regulated by Congress that there shall be not less than 100 representatives, nor less than one representative for every 40,000 persons, until the number of representatives shall amount to 200, after which the proportion shall be so regulated by Congress that there shall not be less than 200 representatives, no more than one representative for every 50,000 persons.
Okay, so do you understand what that said and what this amendment is all about? Probably not. That's okay. Because most people, when they read this the first time, they go, what? In Article 1, right there in Section 1, and so let's go ahead and just turn to that. And if you go to Article 1, Section 1, and we look at the very bottom part of Section 1, because you see, actually it's Section 2, my bad. Section 1 is powers granted in Congress only. The Section 2, it talks about apportionment and representation. And so if you look at the red highlight with yellow font, do you see the number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000? So they're really not talking about, there's not a lot of clarity. And what are they talking about? One to 30,000, 30,000 trees, 30,000 dogs, what is that talking about? But each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration shall be made. In other words, then they actually provide the following: the state of New Hampshire shall be entitled to three. To choose three, Massachusetts, eight. So in other words, they were affixing a very set number of representatives for each of the states until they had the opportunity to have a census, which in 1790, they held a census. And based on this adjusted population, and they did this every 10 years, they would adjust the representation based on the population. Some states would grow, some states may actually lose some population or representation. As a matter of fact, in 2020, California lost 11 representatives because there was that many people from 2010 to 2020 that left the state. 11 representatives. And to date, that's about 750,000. So if you add up 11 representatives, that's easily over 8 million people left the state. Understanding how many illegals were pouring into that state, and they actually count illegals. There you go. So, and they're not supposed to count illegals in the apportionment when we get into the 14th Amendment. And that's probably the only other amendment other than the Bill of Rights we'll probably really linger on. But back to the amendment, the very first amendment that we're talking about, right? This is after the first enumeration required by the first article, there shall be one representative for every 30,000. So that's what I just read. Until the number shall amount to 100. In other words, once they have 100 representatives in the House of Representatives, after which the proportion shall be so regulated. These words were not in Article 1. Congress had no power to regulate the representation. These were affixed to give we the people this balance of apportionment. What kind of government, what form of government are we to have?
A representative.
A representative or a republican form of government. In other words, the foundation of our government is the sovereignty resides with our representation. Our representatives. Now, it's not just our representatives, it's the sovereigns. I go over this time and time again. The reason why the Senate exists is because it offers suffrage for the state legislature. The House of Representatives offers suffrage for the people. And that's why they have very different focuses and very different powers distributed to them through Article 1. Therefore, this representation isn't just we the people. It's not a democracy. It's a representation of sovereignty. Because we the people, when we institute government, we delegate to that government a level of sovereignty over the specific enumerations. Therefore, in the Constitution, these few things enumerated, the federal government is the sovereigns over declaring war, over, you know, foreign aid, or not foreign aid, but foreign trade and foreign treaties of, you know, peace and those types of things. But they don't have an enumeration to adjoin to foreign nations to basically say, you know, we finally got, you know, a real corrupt person into the presidency, and the presidency and the Senate became so corrupt that they could pass a treaty that says we're no longer the United States and we just adjoin ourselves back to Britain. That power is not in the Constitution, so they couldn't do it. They can only make treaties based on the power, because I've emphasized this so many times, but and we just went covered this, I think, yesterday, in the Supremacy Clause. It has to be under their authority. So there were so many checks and balances and firewalls to keep the government from being able to, one, kill itself and or surrender us to, you know, some evil empire like Britain. Yes, evil. But anyway, back to this. So they actually, at this point in time, they now say that it shall be so regulated by Congress. In Article 1, it was not regulated at all. We were fixed that every person, all 30,000 people, would be guaranteed one representative. And if you went over 30,000, you had 35,000 people, then those 5,000 people would have their own representative. And actually what they would probably do was they would split it so there would be kind of equal representation. They wanted to make sure that the people were fairly represented. In other words, to ensure that their voices were heard by their representative in the House. To ensure that somebody that came along with more money, the more affluent person, actually had more pull and influence with that representative. They understood these things. They understood how representation would gravitate towards affluence or those people that, you know, help them get to where they are. Because he who pays the piper calls the tune. That old adage, right? And so whoever is contributing to somebody's campaign, 9 times out of 10, they usually seek advantages for themselves. And so that's one of the reasons why it was fixed. It was fixed at 30,000. And today, folks, by the way, it's still fixed. In other words, we're all guaranteed, every 30,000 people were guaranteed one representative. Now, how many people live in the state of Wyoming?
500,000.
About 500,000. So that means if you take 30,000 into 500,000, you're probably somewhere close to 20, maybe 18 representatives, something like that. So do you guys have
it's
that?
About do you 16 have- representatives.
What's that?
It's about 16, 17.
Okay. So I was just doing beer math. So, okay, 17 representatives. So what is your representation in Congress today? How many representatives do you have?
We have one.
One. There you go. So is the Constitution being applied or is it being violated?
Well, it's definitely being violated.
There you go. Because we should have about, and if you do the math, and oh, by the way, I said this before, illegals, invaders, cannot be represented. When we get to Section 2 of the 14th Amendment, we will cover that. That clearly lays out that the only people that can be counted for apportionment are U.S. citizens, which is one of the reasons why the 14th Amendment, when it granted citizenship to both Indians as well as freemen, then there was going to be a shift where, you know, some of the Western states would actually have an advantage of representation because they had Indian reservations or some of the Southern states because all the slaves, all of a sudden they would get extra representation. And then when we read in section two, it says those people who were denied the opportunity to vote, if you deny their ability to vote, you lose representation for all the people that you denied that right to vote. So section two is really another set of teeth to go after the states to say, not only have we created freemen and, you know, this access to citizenship for all of these people who live here under our jurisdiction, such as Indians and the freemen who were slaves, you know, prior to the Civil War. All of these people now are citizens, which means that they were entitled to representation and that the state would gain that representation. But, oh, by the way, you deny them the abilities and access as a citizen to be able to vote and those types of things, then we're going, you know, then you're going to lose that representation, because that's exactly what Section 2 does. It basically puts some teeth to say you may gain, but if you play any shenanigans against these people to try to take away their suffrage and representation, then you lose that representation.
So why aren't they doing it this way?
Because we've become ignorant of what the law says. The Constitution is the supreme law. Now, it's the Constitution is not as simple as Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not, right? I mean, the Constitution lays out the government. It gives them their roles, responsibilities. It lays out powers so that they can function in what we would call a somewhat complex world of governing. Somewhat complex. I think the Constitution is not that complex. But when we look at, and some people think otherwise, this isn't rocket science, folks. Once you actually dabble into this, I think, you know, the average citizen can get this. It just takes a little time to, you know, put all the pieces together. But again, when we kind of look at this whole intent of this Constitution, just remember that they created a government that anybody could serve. You didn't have to have a clean, you know, bloodline or a blue bloodline. Anybody could serve. That's why the requirements for a representative or a senator or even the president was only citizenship. You didn't have to have a bloodline. You didn't have to have money. A poor person could be a public servant. This was a government for and by and made of the people, even though it was done for and by the states. They acknowledged that the people were the sovereigns, and that's why they had representation in the House of Representatives, and the governments had their representation in the Senate. So, as we kind of go through this First Amendment, I know we've dove into this, but again, as we've dove into this, and we can see how they felt it was so important to maintain this representation, they knew that down the road, the nation would grow to a point where it might actually outpace, you know, the capacity of the House of Representatives. In other words, when they create the Capitol, they hadn't created the Capitol yet. How big of a chamber do they need to house this many representatives? Now, you got to remember, they didn't fathom, you know, virtual meetings. They didn't have the ability to have Zoom meetings, right, so that they could all stay at home. They all had to travel. They didn't have this, you know, these lines of communications where they could just call somebody. They didn't even have the advent of the telephone or the telegraph. Everything was done by Pony Express. I mean, if it was that urgent, and that took days to, you know, travel across a couple of states. I would say probably took a week to go all the way from Maine down to Georgia, you know, or if not more, right? It took time to actually travel that distance. And so it may have been easier and probably more efficient and less, you know, I wouldn't know about costly, but if you traveled from Maine to Georgia via ship, it would probably be a lot easier and maybe as efficient, if not quicker. But nevertheless, they lived in a time when things were very arduous for government to function. We have a lot of technology today. And so I'm pointing out that there's no reason why we can't have 30,000 people represented by one person in the House of Representatives, though the chamber may not be able to seat those people, I think the chamber is obsolete. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because I'm sitting here trying to figure out how you're going to fit all those people into a building.
Right. So when they were planning the seat of government, they actually padded. If you look at how many seats that the House of Representatives accommodates, it's like 400 some odd, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that. So anyway, it's hundreds. And so they made all of this room because they calculated that eventually America would get to that point. Now, one of the things that they started playing with was they tried to redefine representation. Oh, well, representation is not every person, but every registered voter. Well, back in the very beginning, it was persons, right? So when we look at this, we look at, after which proportion shall be so regular by Congress that there shall be not less than one representative nor less than one representative for every 40,000, what's that word? 40,000 persons. They actually say persons. They're not saying voters.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
They're not saying, you know, household owners. Because when we look at who voted at the time that this amendment was created, who were the voters? Property owners. Property owners were the ones, because in every state, they all had poll taxes. And the only people that could vote were property holders. But that doesn't mean that the people weren't being represented. And so, but you had to pay taxes and you had to be a property owner. Well, eventually we changed all of this to start watering it down to saying everybody gets a vote. Well, okay. They actually, even though they had the vote, they still had accountability, because here's the thing. You may not have been able to vote, but do you have a voice with this representative?
Supposedly, yes.
Absolutely you do. As a matter of fact, as we go down to the third amendment, the third article, we'll find that every person, every U.S. citizen has the right to petition their representatives, which means that they do have to account for you. They already kind of understood the complexity, that even though the representation would be based on the affluent property holders, they still had to account for. And we saw that government was, you know, kind of creating favors for property holders, that over time we started realizing that we had to get rid of the poll taxes and access to allow people to be able to have actual voting, because it's like taxation without representation, right? The whole point of the Revolutionary War, we wanted representation. Well, that means that we wanted to have say. We wanted to vote for our representatives. So that became very critical. But the whole point here is this was a huge amendment. And what this amendment did was it highlighted and preserved a Republican form of government, because it was going to allow the people to still have control over that house, because they knew that as the population grew, if they allowed Congress to start meddling with the process, they would actually create the advantages for themselves. And that's exactly what they've done, where the people don't have the same representation. And as a matter of fact, what state has the highest representation, you know, per person, you know, when it goes people to representative, the lower the number is of people to representative, the better representation you get. So what state has the best representation?
I don't know.
Wyoming.
Okay.
Because Wyoming has the least population, least amount of people being represented by Harriet Hagman. When you look at most all of the, so if there's a congressional district out there where that representative actually represents less than Wyoming, then that person is probably, or those people have better representation, because that means that there's less conflict or less, you know, competing voices to have access. In other words, you know, the perfect is a one-to-one, right? If you have one person that's to give you your suffrage, your expectation would be that person would exactly vote precisely how you would demand them to vote.
Mm-hmm.
I told you to do this. Well, these other five people told me to do this. Right. So when you have competition, it actually kind of makes it harder for that person to finally choose. And, you know, they do consensus and that type of stuff. So the point is the less people you have, the better your representation is. And that's why they moved it from 40 to 30. In other words, in the Constitution, when the Constitution was originally being presented for its final signature on the 17th of September, this is when Washington said, I don't like that 40,000. He says, I've kept my mouth shut this entire convention, and I think the people need better representation than 40,000. We need to reduce that to 30. I feel that 30,000 people are far better represented by a representative than 40. In other words, Washington threw his two cents in, and actually they adopted it, they moved, and they made the change, which is, you know, kind of important, because now we can see that we don't want to see a runaway representation because we lose that control. And as a matter of fact, how many businesses today employ, you know, lots of people? As a matter of fact, if you think about it, and you look at the deployment of representation across America, if we maintained 30,000, that means that each business would possibly have very little competition with their own representative. Does that make sense? Because if you're a big employer, like if you have, you know, a hospital network, and I'll give you a good example in Spokane, 20%, the largest employer in the city of Spokane is healthcare. And the largest employer in healthcare is Providence. So it's a tune of 20%, and I'm going to say probably around 12% of that is Providence. So Providence, based on their, you know, being the employer, they have a 12% representation in the city. Now, if it was smaller, 30,000, a hospital could easily be 50, you know, well, I wouldn't say 50, but maybe 30 or 40% of the population. Does that make sense? Or if you're in Detroit, in the old days where you had a large factory, you know, Ford could have actually had their own representation in this congressional district.
Yeah.
And so, in other words, when you start looking at, you know, how things, you know, how we're representing, it all goes to he who pays the piper calls the tune. So if all of a sudden we had corporations able to actually pay and assist in influencing who was going to be our representative, then all of a sudden they would then feel that they had this right to, you know, affluence or influence that representative. In other words, corporations would be split across the spectrum instead of having a whole bunch of them where they're working together, where you've got progressive corporations or conservative and so forth. And when we look at, you know, this conglomeration, the less people we have, it comes down to this, the less people we have in representation, or the higher the percentage of persons to representatives, actually waters down our representation and allows the people that have more money, more voice and more representation, such as the businesses and so forth. And hopefully this all made sense. I'll bring this back up when we come back tomorrow, because this is one of the most important amendments. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.